This past year, we said goodbye to a number of remarkable Iowans. This hour, we remember some of them by looking back at their lives. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, we remember the five Iowa law enforcement officers killed in the line of duty in 2016. Also, the number of bicyclists killed in accidents in Iowa last year was the highest since 2005. We'll talk about that. Also, we remember Pulitzer Prize-winning writer James Allen McPherson and one of the last survivors of the Holocaust in Iowa, recalling some notable Iowans who passed on in 2016. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This past year, we said goodbye to a good number of remarkable Iowans, and this hour, we remember some of them by looking back at their lives. Perhaps you have someone you'd like us to remember. You can go to Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page and tell the IPR community about them on our Facebook page. Later in the hour, the number of bicyclists killed in accidents in Iowa last year was the highest since 2005. 11 people died in fatal bicycle crashes in 2016. We'll talk about that. We'll also remember Pulitzer Prize-winning writer James Allen McPherson and one of the last survivors of the Holocaust in Iowa. But first, five Iowa law enforcement officers were killed in the line of duty in 2016. West Des Moines Police Officer Sean Miller, a 26-year veteran of the force, was killed in August in a traffic accident while on duty. He was posthumously promoted to sergeant. In March, two Des Moines police officers died in a head-on collision on Interstate 80 in a fiery crash that killed four people total. Officers Susan Farrell and Carlos Puente Morales graduated from the Des Moines Police Academy in October. Also among the dead, the prisoner being transported, as well as the driver of the wrong-way vehicle. After the tragedy, I spoke with Sergeant Paul Parizic, public information officer with the Des Moines Police Department, and asked him to tell us about the officers who died.
Susan was a great young lady, and it's not that she was so new to the area. She was kind of a fixture in Polk County law enforcement for about 10 years. I first met her about 10 years ago when she worked in the Polk County Jail, and she had a time of service with the Pleasant Hill Police Department as a reserve police officer, and was actually hired on full-time as a deputy with the Polk County Sheriff's Office before we, the chief actually just said, it is what it is, we stole her away from him. So she was well-known in the community, and the impact that she had here at the department was swift. She's very, very well-respected, inspirational for other officers. And we just got around her with her upbeat attitude, never down. Mm-hmm. Carlos, the exact same way. Every time I met the man, he was smiling. And that seems to be one thing that everybody in the building talks about and his classmates talk about, was just constantly positive. Definitely a self-starter, go-getter, and no stranger to law enforcement himself. He served with the Ottumwa Police Department before coming here, and also a military veteran.
Right. He's a member of the Iowa National Guard, served overseas twice, I see, first in Iraq and then in Afghanistan.
Yeah, he did. Served his country with honor and distinction. And part of the ceremony tomorrow to honor him is going to be with military honors, and his burial will be at the Iowa Veterans Cemetery.
Mm-hmm. I understand that Carlos Puente Morales also was reaching out to youngsters and teens in Ottumwa when he worked there, the Hispanic community especially.
Yeah, and we've had a lot of condolences come to us and a lot of stories shared with us from that community down there. And it seems like he was well on the path to having that same impact on the Hispanic community up here. I know that one opportunity I had to instruct a class out at the academy while he was a recruit, conversation we had sidebar was just that. He wanted to get out there and get involved in our Hispanic outreach. And he said he was still had it in him. He didn't want to get off the street just yet. So the timing was good. He was coming out. He was energetic, and he had a bright future ahead of him, as did Susan.
Mm-hmm. What family do these two leave behind?
Susan has a husband who who is also a member of the law enforcement family, a Pleasant Hill police officer, and a toddler daughter. Carlos has three children and a fiance.
I'm wondering, traditionally, what is done or what is being done for these officers' families and loved ones when such a case as this, when they fall in the line of duty?
Well, the benefits, it's kind of lengthy to go into, but it's fair to say that financially there's not going to be any expense to them. All things are covered. As far as funerals and such go, there are death benefits that the federal government provides them with, life insurance through the city of Des Moines. But most importantly, and Chief Winger touched on this in his eulogy at Susan's funeral yesterday, and I'm sure he'll hit it again tonight at the visitation for Carlos, is that the law enforcement family is going to support them from now until it's over. And I mean until... I guess the best way to say it is we're there for them until the rest of us die. I mean, until we leave this earth, they are part of our family. We're going to take care of them, and we're going to see to it that their needs are always met and they're not left alone.
Mm-hmm. How have the members of your force been coping with the loss? What sort of struggles have you been going through in the last few days?
You know, it's very, very difficult to just, you know, we work in an organization where we just can't put things on pause. Close the doors and, you know, come back when we feel better. It's a 24/7 operation, and we've got a community that is one of the most kind-hearted and generous communities. We are very blessed to serve them, but they also need us, and the expectation is that we're going to be there. So there's a lot going on here behind the scenes to make these funerals happen, and there's a lot going on out on the streets to keep our service delivery where it needs to be. But there's some very, very somber people on both sides of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just been a very difficult time for all of us. I think it's starting to slowly get better. It's going to, you know, we were talking this morning that it's going to change us. I don't think it's going to negatively impact anything within our organization. We certainly would be better if Carlos and Susan were here, but we're going to be different moving forward from this.
Mm-hmm. Change you how? Can you tell yet?
It's like the death of any family member. You know, you just feel like there's just a piece missing. And it's really not something tangible, I don't think, that we can put our hands on. But there's just a part of you that's just not there. And, you know, we need to rise above it, and we will go on and we'll serve their memories well. But we're going to have to move on. You know, it's just going to take some time.
Sergeant Paul Parizic of the Des Moines Police Department. Less than 8 months after a drunken driver killed two police officers in a fiery crash in March, two other officers were shot to death in a shocking ambush-style attack. A 46-year-old Urbandale man, Scott M. Green, a man with a history of personal problems and clashes with the police, was charged with two counts of first-degree murder in the fatal shootings of Des Moines Police Sergeant Anthony Bominio and Justin Martin, an officer in nearby Urbandale. Officer Justin Martin, 24 years old, attended high school in Rockwell City. He joined the Urbandale Police Department in 2015 after graduating from Simpson College. Just days after his death in November, I spoke with someone who had Justin in class, Fred Jones, a professor and department chair of sociology and criminal justice at Simpson College in Indianola. I began by asking him about the impact of the deaths on campus.
Well, the atmosphere at the college, of course, we've all been very saddened. I know on Wednesday, many classes were canceled, or if they weren't canceled, many students just didn't show up because of their grieving. But I think since that time, in addition to the sadness, I think just a lot of us are feeling a great deal of anger because it was such a senseless act or acts.
Mm-hmm. Justin obtained an internship with the Urbandale Police Department while still at Simpson, I understand. He was offered that position in the Urbandale Police Department after graduating. He earned a degree in criminal justice, and we heard from his father this week that he dreamt about wearing that badge since he was in middle school in Rockwell City.
Yes, from day one that I knew Justin. All he talked about, all he wanted to do was be an enforcement officer, and I know that he loved his job, and he was thrilled to be at Urbandale and to work in the metro area. So, yes, it's just very sad and senseless what happened to both men. And by the way, the person that found Justin was also one of our former students. So it was a hard day all the way around for people here.
We have just over a minute, but tell us, what was Justin like in your contact with him?
Well, Justin was kind. He was compassionate. Gentle, quiet. He was very concerned about serving all people in the community. He was concerned with larger social issues. He was concerned with inclusiveness. How do we bring people of different ethnicities and races and religions together? He was very thoughtful. I've often thought that what really marks a person with intelligence is the questions that they ask, and he always asked good questions, penetrating questions that went below the surface of issues. He's just exactly the type of person that you would want to go into police work.
Fred Jones of Simpson College, remembering Officer Justin Martin, taking a few minutes to remember some notable Iowans we lost in 2016. Also killed in that ambush attack in November that killed two Iowa police officers, Sergeant Anthony Bominio, 39 years old, married, father of three children, well-known and liked within the Des Moines Police Department. He joined that department in 2005, where he worked as a school resource officer and a detective. As a young man, he was a state champion wrestler and football lineman at West High School in Iowa City. Also, he was a graduate of Simpson College in Indianola. Shortly after his death, we turned to Steve Foritano to remember his life. Steve is a retired prosecutor and an adjunct professor at Drake University in Des Moines.
Tony was a great guy and a great officer. I started working with him when he joined the Des Moines Police Force 10 or 11 years ago. Saw him rise from a patrol officer to do the school resource officer and then a detective before he finally became a sergeant. But just a great guy and the type of person that you want as a police officer. He was very thorough, very professional, but more than anything, he cared about this community and wanted to be a police officer and wanted to do the things that would help this community.
Mm-hmm. What can you say about how these killings are affecting the Des Moines area community, the contact that you've had with people?
Yeah, there were tremendous shock to the community, and I think it was a tremendous hurt and pain caused to the community. These were two good officers that, not only obviously hurt their families and a tremendous loss to their families and law enforcement, but to the whole community. I mean, these types of attacks are attacking the very fabric of our community, and Des Moines, the Polk County area, has a tremendous diversity and a tremendous sense of community. And I think you're seeing that in the outpouring of support for the officers and also for the local law enforcement community. But, this type of attack, the ambush-style attacks, are just a tremendous tear into the fabric of the community.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit more, perhaps, a time you will remember with Sergeant Bominio that stands out now that we've lost him?
Probably the biggest thing that you remember about Tony was just every time you saw him, there was just a big smile on his face, whether it was on the street or, in the courtroom or at Roosevelt. He was just had a tremendous smile, and the smile was, bigger than his heart. And he was just a great heart and great, like you said, great concern for the community.
Okay. Steve Foritano, thank you very much. Retired prosecutor at the county attorney's office and on the faculty at Drake University. Again, very sorry for your loss. Thank you for sharing a few words about the slain officer, Sergeant Bominio, that we may know a little bit more about this fine public servant that we've lost.
Yeah, he was a great guy. Thank you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, remembering some of the notable Iowans we lost in 2016. 2016 also saw the passing of an important writer, a writer who for many years was part of the Iowa literary landscape, and a writer who influenced and mentored generations of writers. Pulitzer Prize winner and Iowa Writers Workshop Professor Emeritus James Allen McPherson died in July on the 27th. He was 72 years old. McPherson was the author of two story collections, Hue and Cry and Elbow Room. Elbow Room earned him a Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 1978. He was the first African-American writer to be awarded that honor. McPherson became a faculty member at the Iowa Writers Workshop at the University of Iowa. That was in 1981. He was the recipient of several prestigious fellowships, including awards from the MacArthur Foundation and the Guggenheim Foundation. In 1995, he was inducted into the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. A few days after McPherson's death, I spoke with the director of the University of Iowa Writers Workshop, Lan Samantha Chang. I began by asking her to give us a sense of James McPherson's fiction and why it earned him a Pulitzer.
Jim was an extraordinary fiction writer, and one of the great gifts he had was to be able to write very sort of respectfully and beautifully, and also simply about people, his characters, for whom he showed a great deal of respect. Many of his, you know, in his characters, he grew up in the South during segregation, born in the 1940s, and he wrote about people who lived in those circumstances, and he wrote about their lives with such enormous sort of respect and gracious interest. And there's something about his prose, I think, that treats these characters in a way that doesn't call attention to the prose itself. I noticed this particularly recently when I was rereading his work. When he died, several of us happened to be in California at a writers' conference, and we'd all studied with him, including Yi-Yun Lee and the director of the conference and myself, and we sat down with his books for a while and we read them and thought about how sort of beautiful and yet unembellished the writer was, not at all calling attention to the writer, but focusing very deeply on the characters. I actually found it difficult to sort of excise sections of prose that called attention to itself. And I thought that it would be sort of maybe fitting in this moment to read a little bit about what Jim wrote about Iowa in his memoir, Crab Cakes, a really beautiful book. He's just trying to describe a little bit about what Iowa's like to people who might not have encountered it. You know, having grown up in Georgia himself, I think he has a special view of this place. Here, seasons regulate habits. Form here still follows function. Routine inspires the approach to style. In work, towards specific ends, as in nature, the fundamental ends of life are covertly celebrated as nothing more than normal. Speech is therefore plain and muscular. Simplicity is expected, embellishment and pretension politely discouraged. Until recent years, Iowa was said to be, quote, the best kept secret in the country, unquote. The state has benefited thus far from the far-sightedness or the near-sightedness of Easterners and Westerners. Inhabitants are only somewhat aware of the irony at the center of confusion over the whereabouts of the I states. Though the use of irony is little understood or employed here except among the few with intellectual pretensions, most inhabitants of the state would just as well others never learned the difference. Population? 3.5 million and holding steady. Unofficial colors, green, especially during the spring and summer, brown during the fall, and white, winter. Major products, corn, soybean, winter wheat, pork, cattle, civility, peace, and healing. Future, unknown. I recollect that time, too. I remember that I rested in Iowa for many years.
Oh, that's a beautiful passage from Crab Cakes, written by James Allen McPherson, who died on July 27th, read there by the director of the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop, Lan Samantha Chang. Very quickly, before we have to go, Samantha, we don't have much time. How will he be remembered most at the workshop?
Oh, you know, he gave the workshop an extraordinary legacy of love. I often feel that he gave us so much of himself because he came to this town, you know, at a stage in his life where he was really interested in focusing on giving to others. Our community was the wonderful, lucky recipient of this attention and love. He was a wonderful mentor to students, including writers such as Zizi Packer, Yi-Yun Lee, and Marcus Burke more recently. He taught at our program for over 30 years. And as a student of his myself, I will always remember his incredible gentleness in the classroom and the example he set to all of us that a great writer does not need to call attention to himself, but to his subject.
Okay. Thank you very much for helping us celebrate the life of James Allen McPherson, who died on July 27th. Lan Samantha Chang, director of the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, remembering the lives of several notable Iowans who died in 2016. Another loss this year, Gene Wilder, the star of films like Young Frankenstein and The Producers. Wilder grew up in the Midwest, graduated from the University of Iowa with a BA in Communications and Theater Arts. While at the University of Iowa, he featured in student productions and played in summer stock. Wilder was also known chiefly for his comedic genius in movies like Blazing Saddles.
I don't know if you ever heard of me before, but I used to be called the Waco Kid. I was just walking down the street, and I heard a voice behind me say, "Reach for it, mister." And I spun around, and there I was, face to face with a 6-year-old kid. Well, I just threw my guns down, walked away. Little bastard shot me in the ass. So I limped to the nearest saloon, crawled inside a whiskey bottle, and I've been there ever since.
Gene Wilder died at the age of 83. Here he is, singing Pure Imagination for the 1971 movie Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. We'll be back in just a moment with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
There is no life I know to compare with pure imagination. Living there, you'll be free. If you truly wish to be,
it's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The number of bicyclists killed in accidents in Iowa last year was the highest since 2005, according to a report by the Iowa Bicycle Coalition. The nonprofit group that works to promote Iowa cycling says 11 people died in fatal bicycle crashes in 2016. Of those 11 deaths, 9 involved motor vehicles, and 5 of those crashes involved bicyclists struck from behind by motor vehicles. One of those deaths occurred on Iowa's nationally known celebration of biking, RAGBRAI, the Register's annual Great Bike Ride Across Iowa. And that may prompt Iowa lawmakers to address better laws to protect Iowa bicyclists in the new legislative session. In August, I spoke with Des Moines Register Iowa columnist Kyle Munson, also Mark Wyatt, Executive Director of the Iowa Bicycle Coalition. I began by asking Kyle Munson about the recent Ragbrite death.
Well, I mean, on balance, you know, it was another great Ragbrite week. I'm always kind of amazed that, you know, kind of the rolling circus of that scope and size, you know, can happen in any sort of way. But on that first day, we had a gentleman, a retired newspaper editorial writer from Florida, who was not technically on the route, but he was, you know, very much participating in the whole spirit of the ride. He was bicycling west of Glenwood to Missouri River to dip his tire, you know, to kind of the symbolic start of the ride. Mm-hmm. And he was struck early Sunday morning from behind by a truck, and he was killed. So, and this, you know, this was happening just as on this first day of Ragbrite, we had for the first time a mile of silence to, you know, kind of pay tribute to, you know, bicyclists who have died on the road. And, you know, as we've had more of this groundswell of this very conversation we're having today about what can we do to improve bicyclist safety and bicyclist motorist safety on the roads that we're sharing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was all in the very, just as Ragbrite was starting.
Right. And Kyle, as I experienced, I'm sure you did, you're seeking out opinions and stories on Ragbrite. This colored the mood, was on people's minds, of course, with this this death early on the first day.
Yeah. So, you know, it was kind of an eerie experience biking along this mile of silence. And that was, I think I had just, you know, caught the first word of what had happened right before I was on the mile of silence myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So people, it was definitely, you know, especially early in the week, definitely a top of mind conversation among people. I've written before and I've said before that I no longer really feel safe as a bicyclist riding along a two-lane highway under normal conditions. You know, not Ragbrite is a different character. But just myself, you really start to think about how smart a choice is this.
Right. Last month we had a reminder of that. A co-college professor, psychology professor, dying after being hit by a truck, a pickup near North Liberty. So we only have to look to the last month, to June, I guess it's 2 months ago now, to find another. And this is a typical scenario, being hit from behind by traffic going the same way, by a car, being killed that way. Mark Wyatt, your reaction to the flurry of deaths, also the death we experienced on Ragbrite. You were on the ride as well.
Yeah, this is just becoming a repetitive scenario that we're seeing, and we need some sort of intervention to stop the cycle of fatalities. You know, Daniel Lean in North Liberty, Lisa Kuhn over by West Liberty, and Bob Phillips near Nashua have all been overtaking type crashes where the motorist is from behind and they either have claimed they didn't see the bicyclist ahead or they were passing at the time or some sort of circumstances. But this scenario keeps happening over and over, and it's collectively gone on for the past decade as long as we've been tracking fatal crashes. Almost half, actually, over half, have been overtaking style crashes.
Mm-hmm. The Mile of Silence, a dedication, was the first for Ragbrite this year, hosted by your organization, Mark, the Iowa Bicycle Coalition. Tell us a little bit about the background, why you needed a mile of silence. I rode through it there. Boom boxes off, talking, stopping. There too. Why do we need this moment of reflection?
This is building awareness, and this is with the hope that we never have to do this again, that next year that fatal crash number is zero. There's a movement called the Ride of Silence, which is a national movement that holds silent rides during May to remember those that have been injured or killed in bicycle crashes. When we were heard about the five bicyclists that were killed in one crash by a driver allegedly drunk driving in Kalamazoo, Michigan, that was an opportunity for Ragbrite to look kind of at the national picture, but also look at this as an Iowa focus to remember those that were there killed or injured. And then as we got closer to the Mile of Silence, more and more fatalities kept continuing mm-hmm. in this state.
You've started a petition, and now there is a lot of interest in this petition. Tell us about it.
Yeah, prior to prior to RAGBRAI, prior to the Mile of Silence, we started an online petition to ask our state government to start working together to solve this issue. And we've seen, to date, about 7,000 people that signed on to the petition. And these are people that want to take action and want to see action taken to end this cause. It's important. We also put in the petition a full range of solutions that we really need to address. Some of those are policy issues from the legislature. Some of those are infrastructure issues with the DOT and adopting a new state bicycle and pedestrian plan. Some of those are outreach education and driver's ed classes and schools and elementary school for bicyclist education. So there's a lot of solutions that we need. I don't think any one solution can solve the problem alone, but we do need to take things seriously.
A conversation I had in August with Mark Wyatt of the Iowa Bike Coalition and Kyle Munson of the Des Moines Register about the spike in bicyclists killed on Iowa roads in 2016. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, taking note this hour of some of the prominent Iowans we lost in 2016. The Iowa man who defended free speech in the famous 1969 U.S. Supreme Court case, Tinker v. Des Moines, died in October of last year. At just 30 years of age at the time, Dan Johnston successfully defended free speech rights of two Des Moines students who wore black armbands to Roosevelt High School in protest of the Vietnam War. In conversation with one of those students, Mary Beth Tinker, in December of 2015, I asked her how she would describe the significance of that case.
The Supreme Court ruled by 7-2 that neither students or teachers leave their constitutional rights to expression when they enter the schoolhouse gate. And they said that students are persons under our Constitution and that schools should not be enclaves of totalitarianism. And it was a wonderful ruling about what education should be in a democracy, that there should be an interchange of ideas, and that youth need to be able to express themselves in order to model the ideals of democracy, and that if there was ever a place where young people can learn those principles, it should be school.
Johnston also served 2 years in the Iowa House of Representatives in the 1960s and spent nearly a decade as Polk County Attorney in the 70s and 80s. Later in life, Johnston, a gay man, became a pioneer for LGBT rights. In 2014, he was awarded the Louise Noun Award for significant contributions to civil rights in Iowa by the American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa. Dan Johnston was 78 years old. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, remembering some of the notable Iowans we lost in this past year. Jenny Wolnerman, one of the last survivors of the Holocaust in Iowa, died in January of 2016 in her Des Moines home. She was 91 years old. Jenny never wanted future generations to forget the Holocaust, so she shared her story with Iowa schoolchildren. This is part of her story that was shared by her grandson, Daniel Wolnerman, a rabbi from Toronto who gave the eulogy at her funeral service. She was on a Nazi death march when she noticed a loaf of bread sticking out of a German soldier's bag. She was, of course, hungry from the daily brutalities of the concentration camp after her capture in Poland. Now, on the march, she was caught stealing the bread. That meant her life would likely end. Instead, the German guard told her this: if you have the ability to steal from a Nazi guard, you will make it through this. A powerful anecdote told by Daniel Wolnerman about his grandmother, Jenny Wolnerman, one of the last survivors of the Holocaust in Iowa, dying in January of 2016. Joining us now to give us a greater context, Stephen Gaze, professor in the Department of Languages and Literatures at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls, also director of the University of Northern Iowa's Center for Holocaust and Genocide Education. Stephen, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Ben.
I understand you know Jenny's husband and son. What else can you tell us about her and the family?
Well, unfortunately, I was never able to meet Jenny, but I do know some of the people whom she grew up with in her hometown of Benzin, Poland, which is a very, very interesting city in the history of the Holocaust. It's a fairly large city, a center of Jewish life and learning, and at the time that World War II began, it was a city of, with a population, Jewish population of about 30,000, which of course included many, many thousands of children, of whom only about a dozen survived the Holocaust. So this was really kind of the epicenter of the Nazi killing operation. And so Jenny Wollerman was, you know, one of a tiny, tiny number of children, teenagers, who survived the war. And that makes her story, you know, like the stories of so many Holocaust survivors, minor or major miracles.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us an idea of how many Holocaust survivors are left living today in Iowa, in the U.S., in the world?
Well, that's a tough question to answer, because there are different ways of counting Holocaust survivors. As far as we know, Jenny's husband, David, is the last living survivor in Iowa. I think there were, at the most, about 50 Holocaust survivors in Iowa in the years following the war. The conservative estimate is that there are probably about 100 to 150,000 Holocaust survivors still alive around the world. Some estimates are as high as 300, 350,000. Whether there are 100,000 or 200,000 or 300,000, the survivors are dying at a very, very high rate. Probably four or five a day around the world. And what that means is that this generation is the last one that will have contact, face-to-face contact with survivors of the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm. What can survivors contribute to our understanding of the Holocaust that we can't read in a book, see in a film?
Well, I can tell you anecdotally, in the 6 years that the Center for Holocaust and Genocide Education has been in existence, we've made a real conscious effort, especially in recent years, to bring survivors to campus and to our community as frequently as possible. And what I see every time a survivor comes to our area, and I know this is true everywhere, is that there's a tremendous connection between school children, adults, college students, to be in the presence of someone who survived that event. Usually at a middle school or junior high school, after a survivor speaks, you know, students who would normally not respond openly to almost anything just want to rush up and hug the survivor and have that physical, visceral contact with someone who lived through those times. And I think that obviously is going to be lost when there are no longer any living survivors of the Holocaust. And it's people like Jenny Wollerman who, you know, as long as she lived and was able to speak to school groups and other groups, you know, who really helped to keep the memory of that event and the need to remember very much in our consciousness. One Holocaust survivor said that remembrance is a form of redemption, and I think that's what the community of survivors collectively would say, that in remembering we redeem ourselves and try to keep the lesson of that time alive.
All right. Thanks for joining us again. Stephen Gaze, professor in the Department of Languages and Literature at the University of Northern Iowa, also director of its Center for Holocaust and Genocide Education, helping us remember Jenny Wollerman, one of the last survivors of the Holocaust in Iowa, who died in January of 2016. Stephen, thank you.
Thank you.
River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, taking note this hour of some of the prominent Iowans we lost in 2016. W.P. Kinsella was a graduate student at the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop when he began writing his story, Shoeless Joe, the story about a farmer who decides to create a baseball diamond in his field of corn after seeing the ghost of Shoeless Joe Jackson, a Chicago White Sox outfielder, was turned into a movie, you guessed it, Field of Dreams. In the movie, Kevin Costner's character, Ray, is facing the decision of selling his farm, and Terrace Mann, played by James Earl Jones, reassures him.
People will come, Ray. They'll come to Iowa for reasons they can't even fathom. They'll turn up your driveway, not knowing for sure why they're doing it. They'll arrive at your door, as innocent as children, longing for the past. Of course, we won't mind if you look around, you'll say. It's only $20 per person. They'll pass over the money without even thinking about it. For it is money they have, and peace they like.
Ray, just sign the papers.
And they'll walk out to the bleachers. Sit in shirt sleeves on a perfect afternoon. They'll find they have reserved seats somewhere along one of the baselines. So they sat when they were children and cheered their heroes. And they'll watch the game. And it'll be as if they dipped themselves in magic waters. The memories will be so thick that I have to brush them away from their faces.
People still do come to Iowa to play ball on that baseball diamond where the movie was shot, which still stands in Dyersville today. Kinsella published nearly 30 books of poetry, fiction, and nonfiction. He died at 81 years old. Remembering this hour, a few of the prominent Iowans who passed in 2016. Iowa sports commentator Bob Brooks died in June of 2016. Brooks was a broadcaster for 7 decades, covering the Iowa Hawkeyes and all manners of Cedar Rapids sports. He worked in both radio and television for KCRG. He did play-by-play for the Hawkeyes and sports reports for many Cedar Rapids radio stations, most recently at KMRY. Here he is explaining how he got his start in broadcasting.
I got started when I was in high school in Cedar Rapids, mainly because of World War II. It's kind of a complicated story, but at that time, WSUI, the university station, really didn't have any male voices because the draft and people were in the Army. I was still in high school, so I took what was then the interurban from Cedar Rapids and came down here to WSUI, and I never missed a beat.
Iowa basketball is on the air. How you doing, everybody? This is Bob Brooks from the Hawkeye Sports Arena, where tonight Iowa tries.
Bob Brooks was 89 years old. Finally, to end our remembrance of some of the notable Iowans we lost in 2016, Jane Ann, or as she was known, Janie Hernandez Hooper, a giant in the Des Moines music scene, died in October. Hooper started playing around Central Iowa in the 1970s and brought a soulful voice and gorgeous piano playing to Des Moines' jazz, blues, gospel, R&B, and funk scene for 40 years. She performed with some great artists like Robert Cray, Lonnie Brooks, Buckwheat Zydeco, and Lou Christie. She accompanied Chuck Berry for the Iowa caucuses celebration. Here she is singing Autumn Leaves for Great Day in October of 2015. This is just before she was inducted as the Community Jazz Center Jazz Hall of Fame's 45th member.
Since you went away, the days grow long, and soon I hear old winter song, but I miss you most of all, my darling, when autumn leaves start to fall. The falling leaves drip by my window, the autumn leaves of red and gold. I see your lips, the summer kisses, sunburned hands I used to hold. Since you went away, the days grow long, and soon I'll hear.
River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
When autumn leaves start to fall, when autumn leaves start to fall, when autumn leaves start to fall.